Welcome to the Meaning of Home podcast, where we discuss the complexities and connections between home and homelessness. I'm your host, Sarah Christou, and as always, with me is the podcast's producer, Dave Angel. We are doctoral researchers at Loughborough University, part of the Harnessing Opportunities for Meaningful Environments Centre for Doctoral Training, for short, the Home CDT. We are a cohort of seven PhD projects approaching concepts of home and homelessness through a creative lens to develop impactful new research. Every month, we'll bring a new episode with a range of guests to provide commentary and conversation on different themes. In this episode, our theme is disparity, where we'll be discussing the inequitable design of cities. Today, we are delighted to be joined by Noran Bassam, founder of Gaming X and author of The Gendered City. Noran is an architect, feminist designer, and city enthusiast. She uses place and playmaking to guide communities to shape their own inclusive and sustainable cities. As founder and CEO of Gaming X, a think tank that focuses on community development, Noran works to create play spaces that are accessible for all members of the community, especially marginalised groups. In addition, she conducts research to better understand the experiences of women in cities, including their mobility patterns, safety concerns, and access to economic and social opportunities. As creator of the Gendered City project, she amplifies the attention given to the restrictions and failures that women face in cities using a range of initiatives and has recently published a book under the same title. Welcome, Noran, to the Meaning of Home podcast. So, as I said, we're discussing disparity with a particular focus on how women experience cities. As the design of our cities replicates and reinforces structural inequalities, urban spaces serve those who hold power and so underserve those who are marginalised. Taking into consideration safety risks, inadequate transport, limited access to services, and navigating public spaces, could you tell us more about how the design of cities restrict and fail women?
So, yeah, as you mentioned, cities have been designed, I would say, for the default male for years and years. So historically, this is how cities were built. And this is like the question I posed, I say, 2 years ago, how cities keep failing women. And it's about highlighting and knowing and listening and humanizing data and listen to the voice of women. And as well, we will go through this, but intersectionally. So it's not only women, but gender diverse, people from different socioeconomic background, class, ethnicity. So it's this whole, I would say, marginalization or who is not in the center of the wheel of power, or like we would say that the white, heteronormative, patriarchal male. So the root cause of cities failing women, I would say this systemic gender inequality and discrimination that was deeply engraved and ingrained, and I blame the patriarchy for it, in social and economic and political structures. And as I mentioned, this is historically how cities, transportation systems, streets, even snow clearing schedules were designed for, we would say, the normal male. So as far as design, even like generally was concerned, it was for the default male. And this is how it's not working for, we would say, more than 50% of the population. So it's restrictive within mobility and opportunities, overall well-being and health, etc. So, and this is like more we will go into, I think, deeper into all of these spectrums. But I mean, like, this is historically what felt normal or was default. And then I think women were, and all the marginalized people were accustomed that, like, this is the reality, we face it. So you go home early, you feel unsafe in streets, and this is it, you have to deal with it somehow. But hopefully now we're trying to change this.
That made me think about the fact that when we're talking about the design of cities, we also have to think about who the designers are. because if the designers are predominantly, like as you mentioned, white, cisgendered, able-bodied men, then the designs that they have also reflect, whether purposefully or inadvertently, those designs then reflect that less inclusive, equitable components of what is being experienced, who the city is for. So who designs for who, essentially. And so the methods of design and its impact may not be intentionally part of power structures, but they do end up being influenced by it. And this is also why we need feminist ways of doing design as well. And so what then are the main issues with the design of urban spaces in particular?
So I think this is the main premise of feminist urbanism. So as a feminist urbanist, I would say we are focusing on how to design with a feminist perspective. So the issues, we would say, first of all, a lack of accessibility. So this is like the physical even structuring of cities, like the built environment, from ramps and the width of the pavements, the inadequate public transportation, as we mentioned, and this is very much vividly, the inequality is very vivid in the transportation system that is very dominated by men. So women would even be like, and especially caregivers, and we know that women do the 75% of the caregiving and unpaid domestic care work. So transportation plans tend to cater for men's work routines. So with the scenario of men going from point A to point B with their car or with a train one way, this is how transportation was designed, and not neglecting, we would say, what we call trip chaining in the transportation terminologies, and this is what women and caregivers do. So women would do the scenario of going to drop off kids at school, then going to work, and then getting kids from school, maybe caring for a senior relative, and then going to grocery store to prep dinners, and then go home. And this is what we call trip chaining. So these short, interconnected transportation that women have to go through, that for the longest time and still now in many municipalities, it's called leisure activities, while women have to bear all of this, and making the most percentage of the urban poor. So women mainly are people who are walking in the streets and using public transportation system. So they're not using their car or one way route. They are doing all the trip chain. And it's hindered a lot of women from even working or be like in the work or the, we say, the formal economy equal to men. And it led for, we say, centuries of women bearing all of the caring responsibilities with transportation not designed for men. So this is like in a transportation kind of a lens, and we say we're in a safety concerns. So it places it when inadequate lighting, poorly designed alleys, secluded areas that lack surveillance or lacked people, because no amount of light will dismantle the patriarchy, and we will go through this too. But it's all of the safety concern as well, hindered women from being, for instance, physically active. So as a woman, you are afraid for your safety after dark, so you will not be doing physical activity. Maybe you will need to pay for a private gym or so, and then you are paying more, and with the pay gaps, you are already, your salary is less, and it's a whole, we would say, restrictive connected system of how cities are hindering women in that sense. So this is like, for instance, what comes to my mind from the physical design of cities that for the longest was not enabling women to have equal, we would say, lifestyles as other, as men or other identities, yeah.
And just that last bit at the end made me think that plays into also the rhetoric of shifting responsibility onto individuals to have to adapt their behaviour to the city, to the design. So this plays into, you know, this narrative that we hear so often of women should avoid going out at night, or women should not travel alone, or women should not go to that area. And so the onus is on women to adapt and change their behaviour rather than to address those root causes. And I suppose then that's just one small area in terms of thinking about, you know, physical safety and the spaces that we're in. But that then folds out into so many other aspects of what can limit and restrict a woman's life. And so then that impacts all decision making in terms of mobility, perhaps where you might accept a position for a job, as to what that commute or route to that place may be, where you would have to go for that. The same in terms of decision making about where you will live, as to what access you might have or not have to transport, whether you've got the services that you need around you as well. And then thinking about that mobility and how that's impacted through urban design, I wondered what your thoughts are on the concept of the 15-minute city. Is that part of a feminist urbanism?
So actually in the book, I talk a lot about proximities and the caring city model. And this is how the 15-minute city intersects with proximities, and how it works with the caring system, doing the care work and the small trips and the small commutes women have to do, of course it's very much in favor of the caring model city. It's you have everything you need in a very close, we would say, and connected to your home, so you can do the drop-offs to the nursery, to the you go to work, do the grocery shopping, all in a walking distance or using like adequate transportation system. And well, it's always as well how to avoid, and this is something that you need to design the 15-minute city as well with a feminist perspective, because you need to avoid gentrification too. And we know now that mostly maybe in the suburbias in Barcelona, when they have this square blocks that is green and nice, and mothers with strollers are walking through it and everything. But we see a lot of like high rate renting in these streets. They became, I would say, the like hot spots and very much attractive to everyone. So they become like higher in rent. And this is how, of course, this shows the need for this, so people love it because it's livable, it's close by, it's all of these positives. But then the streets that are not included in the suburbia, they are lower in rent, and we would say these areas are highly facing gentrification in a way.
That made me think, that notion of care and establishing care, that comes up quite a lot in feminist design theory or in feminist design practice. If I think of the teachings of Sheila de Bretville on establishing care and building relationships between people, or drawing on Sara Ahmed's work on how being a feminist designer is about obviously challenging inequitable ways of design that have been done, but also to demonstrate care through design and to transform the discipline through inclusive collaboration as well. Not that it's a manual, here is a feminist design manual, but actually the whole point of it is that it's always evolving and responding to the needs that are there. And again, also the point of gentrification made me think of the importance of housing as a human right as well. And I know a film from a couple of years ago by Leilana Faha, who at the time was the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, went all over the world to try to understand who's being pushed out of the city and how there's a crisis that's escalating even beyond gentrification on this kind of these faceless places of living which aren't actually inhabited but are used for investment, and the financialization of homes as well, and these increasingly unlivable cities. And she said, quote, I believe there's a huge difference between housing as a commodity and gold as a commodity, because gold is not a human right and housing is. And I think that is core to the, you know, feminist urban design as well, that we're talking about making sure that cities are livable and livable for everyone as well. And you can't take that into consideration if the same people are only ever part of the process of how our cities operate, who's running them, how they're designed, who's the decision makers, essentially. And that kind of brings me back to your book that you have recently published, The Gendered City. So, yes, we're thinking then about how the city is gendered. But, I mean, can you tell us, why should others care? Why should everyone care? And how are we talking about this as considering the city as being gendered?
So yeah, for instance, it's when we say the city is gendered and why everyone needs to take action. So, and when we say feminist city is not a city for women, it's a city for the 99.9%. So we mean all the voices that historically, as we mentioned, been marginalized or silenced or not listened to. It means we need to incorporate into design systems. And this is what makes us think that when you are an architect, a designer, and an urban designer, you need to start with knowing what people want. So what people need is really vital. And when you ask this question, you need to be, I say, radical inclusive to get everyone answering this question, to see who is not there answering the question. So you need to be radical inclusive in incorporating the diverse voices of everyone in the very specific community too, because I would say it's always contextual and it's always different from one place to another. So as you said, it's not tailor-made, it's not like a toolkit that you need to follow. So, and I'm an architect myself, and I would say for the longest architectural schools, they teach you as an architect, you design everything. So basically you don't think there is a need to listen to whoever thinks of your design. So you design everything, even like the chairs inside the house. So as an artist, architect, and designer, this is the I think how architecture and design schools are focused. But then a lot of readings, and I think Jane Jacobs and William White and the whole placemaking movement, because this is what really changed my paradigm into thinking how like the community is the expert. People know what they want, and they need to be involved into the decision making process. So when we say everyone should be included and everyone voices should be incorporated into the design process, and this puts us to mention Make Space for Girls, and this is very much shows how it's really vital to listen to the teen girls specifically needs within their playgrounds. So teen girls in parks and public spaces is really very small compared to boys, and when they like dig deeper, they found like the disparities even reached 90 to 10%. So the skate parks and the moogas, like the multi-use game areas and the pitches and the BMX tracks, all boys, and girls are on the periphery of these places, and leads to the long term of girls and women not being involved into the physical activity as much as boys and teen boys. So, and we have seen this, we are like growing up, maybe one of the girls on the periphery hit in the face by the ball, and this is it. So you're not really involved in the process. And this needed to change, or when they decided to change, like how to make it work for girls, then you need to ask girls what they would feel like a safe and nice playground for them look like. And then you can start from there envisioning how is it to design an adequate playground or recreational area for the teen girls. And this is how it is well very much different from one context to another, and their perception of safety and security, their perception of what is for them works. And like many girls said, maybe we can see people and not be seen, like the huge swings, so we can have some social interaction, the unprogrammed like areas that can has like very much flexible, different games. So, and this is like, I think very brilliant, because you get like whatever their ideas and what really people want, rather than what designers in their offices used to design all the past years. And really led to this disparity and this, we would say, inequality. So, yeah.
And that reference there, obviously, to make space for girls, in particular, they're thinking about teenage girls and parks, made me think of there was a report last year, 2022, by ARUP and UNDP, titled Cities Alive, Designing Cities That Work for Women. And in that, as among many statistics, it highlights that 97% of women in the UK have experienced sexual harassment in public spaces. 97%. And that's what's been reported as well. So we often hear this equated to women feel unsafe in cities, or women feel unsafe in public spaces. But perhaps that should be flipped, as in reality, it is the cities making women feel unsafe. Obviously, I've been highlighting again about women's experiences. But of course, as you mentioned before, we're not just talking about women. We're talking about lots of other identity markers as well, and how other marginalized groups experience cities. So could you perhaps expand on that? How are our cities problematic beyond gender, for example, age, disability, ethnicity, class?
When we go to ethnicities and segregation and gentrification, as we said, so ethnic minorities might face segregation, limited access to resources as well, limited access to affordable housing. And we have seen a lot of disparities as well for maybe single women or people from different ethnicities have this, the right to housing, as you mentioned. So discrimination can come as well from the ethnicities, the background, and this is how people can be marginalized from, and of course class. So it gets us again to transportation and accessibility and housing affordability, and then the sexual diverse and how they feel safe and unsafe in certain places. And I had a lot of testimonies as well from sexual diverse, transgender, and how cities are failing them too. So, and this is the whole intersectional lenses, and all of us are like fit in many of these groups. So this is how, when you say we are designing for inclusivity for the feminist city, so you are incorporating the 99.9%, you are incorporating as well the intersectional biases and the intersectional lenses that you fit in many of these categories. So yeah.
I think that's really interesting, and it made me think also perhaps more closely aligned in particular with the focus of our podcast and the research that we do on home and homelessness as well, is hostile architecture as an urban design strategy, where we see elements that are used in the built environment to purposefully restrict behaviour as well. And this often targets those who rely more on those public spaces, either such as young people, where there's nowhere to go, nothing for them to do. And so there are tactics of architecture used to discourage young people from hanging around, in the same way that that's used for people experiencing homelessness to restrict their behaviour. In particular, when I think of like the city that I'm in, which is London, the most aggressive form of this hostile architecture being spikes. Spikes put on underpasses, spikes put on walls, fences, spikes put through parks. They might be like spiked concrete, deliberately placed to discourage people experiencing homelessness from sleeping or resting. And they're the most noticeable ones, but some others that you highlighted there that may impact you based on age, may impact you based on disability as well. And the more you know about it, the more you notice it then around you too, such as bus stops having very narrow sloped seating, so you can't sit on them for long and you can't lie down on them, so it wouldn't be possible actually to sleep or rest there. And benches in parks having bars put across the middle of them, again, so that you can't sleep and rest there. And so there is also now a phenomenon of purposefully restricted architecture that we see in our urban environments. So it's not even sort of incidental or hasn't been thought out well. It's been designed on purpose. I wondered if you could speak a bit more about that.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it became really funny because I've been documenting some of the hostile architectural elements that are put there for a purpose, like even to let like make people not sit on the bench or maybe sit in a very, very like hostile bench that it's very uncomfortable that you sit there for like probably 3 minutes and that's it and you need to leave immediately. So yeah, even like this culture against, of course, unhoused and like a different population to not let people be like social. And this is like why you say that even placemaking is a radical concept for some cities, that that they don't want this kind of social interaction. And because they know that everything happens in the public space, all the change, all the even political change, social changes, everything. So some like policies, they, as you said, they intentionally make public spaces not accessible. So even the able-bodied, the everyone, like it's not accessible even for them. So so I think this is why as well it's sometimes frustrating, because it's a grassroots movement. It's you know, you are trying to embed the ideas of inclusivity into policies and into municipalities, because we cannot design on a wider scale without having systemic changes. And this leads us to that to even in gender, so gender mainstreaming and this idea of like how we need policy and decision makers to make the significant influence to implement policies and prioritize inclusivity and sustainability and equity in urban planning. So from the like the housing policies, as we said, to budget allocating into gender, to gathering gender disaggregated data and sex disaggregated data, and this is really necessary to move forward to more inclusive designs, is to gather data to try to make change and to make it a systemic change. And this always, you know, the struggle, and even for my like friends in senior positions when they are trying to work with municipalities, and then they're a bit resilient to gather gender disaggregated data or to call it even feminist design policies. And this is like even in Western societies. So We say that it's taking a bit longer than it should. It's very logical, it's very common sense, but yet not widely implemented, right? So yeah, it's somehow this leads that we are doing what we do as people in grassroots or as NGOs, but then a systemic change and it's like an obligation in municipalities. So it's gender mainstreaming, it's a department to design with gender inclusivity is really crucial and necessary to make the long-term impact, the systemic impact. Yeah.
And I think they're taking kind of representation particularly as important. The World Organization of United Cities and Local Governments estimates that around 20% of city councillors and just 5% of mayors globally are women. And so gender disparity persists in our cities, as there is unequal representation in both private and public decision making. You've started to highlight how that can change and the importance of reimagining our urban spaces from an intersectional perspective. But obviously that also needs to start with those decision makers. So how can we change our cities to be better for everyone?
So actually, like I say, that it's always because this, I think, patriarchy and gender inequality is really embedded within, like, you can start from your own family, from your own position, whatever it is. So this is really important. It starts at really small scale from oneself to change these narratives and gender norms and gender roles. Because, of course, urban design is not only is not enough, and especially for when we talk about safety and security, etc. So first of all, it's really small and incremental, and this helps and this works. So this is the, I would say, the good, the bright side, because sometimes you get demotivated when it's not moving. As you mentioned, not a lot of representation in municipalities, as mayors, as people in decision-making tables. But it really, I think, incremental changes work too and make change too. So we start there, we start really small, and then we and as well educational institutions and promoting the gender inclusivity and the civil society movement and all of the advocacy groups, it can work and it works. And then, as I mentioned, urban planners and architecture and architects and the architectural schools and education to have the professional these fields to integrate inclusive designs, to integrate place for conversation, for incorporating the diverse needs in infrastructure and public space, and to ensure that all the voices are heard. This is really important. So people who are designing actually can. Like we can work from there too, and they say that and in the community engagement and empowering communities to actively participate, and this is of course not easy. So incorporating everyone to be active in the decision making and to ensure that everyone is included and no one is, and it's not a fake tokenized process that. Not really reflecting the diverse needs. It's a long story, but it's really important to suggest ideas, to co-create solutions, and this whole co-creation of architects and urban planners within the community and with the community. So I would say it's that you can invert the pyramid. So.
Yeah, and right back to that top, back to that power dynamic, and where design's relationship to power is part of what were the term coined by the Black feminist scholar Patricia Hill Collins of The Matrix of Domination. So, of course, referring to interlocking systems of white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, capitalism, settler colonialism as well. So, in effect, to change the design, we have to dismantle power itself and look at where that is where and how that is relating and to who. And we come back to the question of who is designing and who are they designing for. I wondered, maybe as you kind of ended on a note of hope there as well, if we move into kind of a more positive progressive thinking, are there examples of cities or projects you want to highlight that are designing more inclusive spaces?
So it's always, there is a place for hope, and there's always a lot of, I would say, successful projects in feminist urbanism that worked and that are working. And we mentioned, actually, you mentioned the 15-minute city and proximities, and this is how as well the Subarella works, very much aligned with proximities and the 15-minute city. So I would say as well, 30 years ago, Vienna in Austria, they incorporated gender mainstreaming in urban planning, and they have actually like a department to gather data. So when they started to like the first thing when they mentioned gender mainstreaming, they mentioned like a survey, a questionnaire, know what actually people need, and they tried to as well gather sex disaggregated data in transportation systems. So this they incorporated gender mainstreaming, I would say, a long time ago in Sweden. They have this, even as I said, the gender, the snow clearing, gender equals snow clearing. So they knew that women and caregivers are the people who are using the pavements that were lastly actually cleared, and it's caused a lot of disparities that people who are using the pavements and even cyclists and active mobility is not working because you're prioritizing cars and basically men's commutes. So they have done that, and it's as well like Umeå in Sweden, they have the gender mainstreaming department. We have seen like a lot of projects that like the research projects in Leeds, the Safer Park projects, trying to inform as well and redesign some of the parks to be more gender sensitive designed, and the care blocks in Bogota, and it's really promising with the female mayor. It's a very promising program to be replicated in many parts. It's like as well very much similar to the proximities and Subarellas, but you know, takes like some of this and then some of this with the caring model city, and it really is working, and I would say as well making human, you know, like humanizing cities and designing with this human green mentality is very much intersecting with how you make it as well safer and more inclusive even for women. So we hope more municipalities apply gender mainstreaming, and we hope as well everyone starts with gender desegregated data, and like even in the projects I'm involved in, so it's the needs of the community, and it's the gender desegregated data that you need to start from to make a place more livable, more women friendly, and as we mentioned, like very much all the 99.9%, so more inclusive. Yeah.
A home for everyone, then.
A home for everyone. I love this. Yeah.
We end every episode of the podcast with a recurring segment where I ask each guest the same question. What does home mean to you? Noran, what does home mean to you?
I think home for me is some of my favorite books, and when they are there in that place, I feel home. So, and there are some of the books as well I grew up reading, and me and my dad always discussed somehow, because they made me, I think, the feminist I am today, the woman I am today, and yeah, some of them are like maybe The Second Sex of Simone de Beauvoir, Sister Outsider, Audre Lorde, and actually Bill Hooks as well, and yeah, some of these books are really, you know, sometimes I feel like they're there, so this is home, and I can always like read even like one pager or two to on the sad days. Yeah,
that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you Sarah for having me.
That brings us to the end of this episode. We would like to thank our guest, Nooran Bassam, for joining us and sharing her thoughts. For more information about our work, please visit meaningofhome.uk. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at meaningofhomelu. Remember to follow and share our podcast. Finally, and excitingly, the Home CDT has an exhibition coming up called Within and Without Home, hosted at Charnwood Arts Centre from the 5th to the 16th of February. It features mixed media pieces including photography, soundscapes, virtual reality and interactive exhibits. Please do come along to the exhibition and follow our socials for more information. This podcast was created by the Home CDT. It was hosted by Sarah Christou, produced and edited by Dave Angel, and the music is by the Angel Brothers. All ideas expressed in this podcast are those of the individual. The Meaning of Home is brought to you by doctoral researchers at Loughborough University.